Okay. Are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Michael H. Price, and thank you for all the books that you've done and all the books that you have brought me aboard on. I appreciate that.
Yes. Well, we keep on cranking, don't we?
We're going to do it till we get it right, and we want everybody to know with Christmas coming on, nothing says I really appreciate you more than a book from Michael H. Price or John Woolley. And with that in mind, the new first, and it's called, tell me what the new first Forgotten Horrors is called.
It's a mouthful. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Forgotten Horrors, the original volume, except more so.
There you go. All right. And that is ready to go, and that features a discussion of the film we're talking about tonight, a very strange picture called The Scent of Norma Red.
Oh, I'd say it is.
It's a wonderful picture. I really enjoyed the picture. Joey and I watched it a couple weeks ago, Joey, I guess. And it's a pretty amazing film. And I don't want to step on the things that you say about it, but let's just talk a little bit about it. First of all, we were talking about this the other night, you and I, or the other day, and you said that it owes something to another picture, which I did not know. Can you illuminate us on that?
Well, they're not exactly companion films, although they did come out very close together during 1933. Mm-hmm. The Sin of Nora Moran follows the example of a much bigger picture, that is Preston Sturges' famous Spencer Tracy picture, The Power and the Glory, in which the crimes against humanity of a mighty philanthropist mm-hmm. are revealed in flashback at his funeral.
So you're essentially then talking about the structure of Nora Moran
is similar to
this.
Yes, and we think of flashback technique as belonging to the film noir style that came to flower during the war and post-war years, that is, World War II. Mm-hmm. But, of course, nothing happens all at once. There have to be foreshadowings and antecedents, and certainly that's what we receive in the use of very structured flashbacks. A lot of films use flashbacks so emphatically and deploy them so liberally that you don't dare come in 10 minutes after the picture is started.
Right.
Lest you know, David Lynch uses a similar technique in his films of the modern day.
Mm-hmm.
I would think Lost Highway would be an example of that. Mm-hmm. But it all owes to a very emphatic introduction of flashback technique to dramatic advantage in Power and the Glory, and very soon thereafter, in 1933, The Sin of Nora Moran. There's a name for that technique. It doesn't get used because it's a very awkward word made up by the studio publicists for The Power and the Glory, and that word is narratage.
A narratage. And so it's spelled like
studio flax, clever way of combining narrative with montage.
Okay.
And of course, the word probably, fortunately, failed to catch on. Let's go see if this film has a lot of narratage in it.
You know what, it may not have been uttered for perhaps decades before you just uttered it tonight. It's one of those words I've never heard. I've never heard narratage. It makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense. It describes the technique that both the famous people responsible for the Power and the Glory and the rather more obscure people who handled Nora Moran.
Well, now, Nora Moran, though, when you say narratage, that really does describe it.
When things happen in our lives, we're conscious of them as events. And later, subconsciously, we see our lives as a pattern. And it's easy to recall the events that form that pattern. And so it was with Nora. She was in a cell waiting to die. And yet she was in the circus. She was dreaming, but yet in her subconscious mind, she was reliving the events that formed the pattern of her life.
And I'm curious, how this happens in 1933. Nora Moran comes out. A lot of people, if they know Nora Moran at all, they know it because the poster is so striking and provocative that it's really the image has come down to us. But
it's
also
a poster that could not have been published the following year after the Legion
right.
of Decency got its hooks into the film industry.
Exactly. In 1934, that would have been all over with, along with all of the dams. I say all the dams. There are several uses of the word dam in the film, which wouldn't have been tolerated.
By 1934, a studio didn't dare use the word damn mm-hmm. unless it was prepared either to be censored or to pay a fine,
mm-hmm.
Like bribery. I'll bribe you to let me use this word.
Kind of like
paying to take a defensive driving course instead of paying the speeding ticket.
What kind of an impact would you say? And it's I always try and find analogs to the B Picture Studios of yesteryear to today. And of course, it's all out the window now because of home video and home DVDs and all that kind of stuff. But Majestic, it was a Poverty Row studio. What kind of but occasionally a Poverty Row studio film broke out. Did Nora Moran break out? Was it a hit? Was it a success?
It caused no sensation whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
Although it was appeal. I think that very provocative poster probably attracted more traffic than the film itself.
Probably the raincoat crowd, wouldn't you imagine?
Well, you never know because it's not a film for the family trade.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with murder and capital punishment, rape,
mm-hmm.
suicide, political corruption, a lot of foreshadowing here of both film noir of the 40s and the films of Ingmar Bergman.
It does, and I would say even more the latter than the former, because in the film's noir, it seems like the whole concept of the suffering woman, the woman who sacrifices herself for a greater ideal or even for a man, whether he's any good or not.
Definitely, and of course that's another element that came to flower in the 1940s when Hollywood started specializing. A lot of studios made a point of producing what the trade called women's pictures.
Mm-hmm. Even women's directors, didn't you?
In other words, a strong woman character, self-sacrificing or not, usually self-sacrificing, but sometimes tyrannical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, Nora Moran knows exactly what she's doing in taking the rap for a murder for which she is not responsible.
Could we go ahead and just give a very brief synopsis of the picture for those who haven't seen it? And of course, the good news is you can see, because it's a public domain film, you can see it on any number of websites. We saw, what was the website we saw it on, Joey? It was a beautiful print. What was the website?
It's a good clean print on archive.org.
Okay, that's it. And Joey's going to put a link up also with this podcast.
I don't like to prescribe medicine, but people really need to see this picture
yes,
to get a fuller understanding of what the Poverty Row studios were capable of doing. We associate it's not a district. Poverty Row is more a state of mind and economics.
Exactly.
Although a lot of the studios were concentrated in a certain area of the motion picture capital.
Around Gower Street, sure.
The artistic, it's not just flourishes. The film is, in essence, an artistic picture. The story has to do with, Zita Johann from The Mummy.
Who is absolutely gorgeous.
A magnificent beauty and a fine actress who never quite got what she deserved. She plays Nora Moran, a young woman who has a show trash background. Very tragic past life, hooks up as the mistress of a rising politician. There is a murder committed. She did not do it, but she is sentenced to be executed.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to reveal the truth, she would have to ruin a number of other careers and probably other lives.
And yet she
very
would have every
a
right.
A real quandary.
She would have every right to do it because she has never really, I mean, it's very fatalistic, the film, because she's never really deserved any of the negative things that have happened in her life.
No, she doesn't deserve having a lousy, corrupt, malicious boss.
Or having parents, having her foster parents die in a car wreck.
Right.
Or
losing
being an orphan.
Everything that matters, not once, not twice, but three and four times. Wonderful supporting cast. Alan Dinehart, one of the great oily villains of old Hollywood.
And he does an interesting turn here, I think.
Oh, yeah. The district attorney who has larger ambitions, the circle of friends, colleagues, hangers-on, people who nurture his career, even though there are questionable aspects. Wonderful ensemble. John Milgen as the circus boss, who really shouldn't be entrusted with such a fragile beauty as Nora Moran.
Good point.
Paul Cavanaugh as the governor. Claire Dubray all these wonderful faces. Henry B. Walthall, one
yes.
of D.W. Griffith's late great leading men.
Yes.
Talkies came in. He lost his star power, but he kept his power.
Mm-hmm. And he had a pretty good secondary career as a character actor, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Sarah Patton, one of the great grandmotherly figures.
And was in a lot of B-Westerns, as I recall.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Well, it's a wonderful cast, and it's Zita Johann, obviously kind of carries the show, but it's also based on a stage play. And I'm curious if you know anything about that stage play.
The stage play was not a success.
Oh.
It had a background. The story from which it originated was called Burnt Offering by mm-hmm. Willis Goodhue.
Mm-hmm. Probably because it was not a success that Majestic was able to buy it. Otherwise, it would have been perhaps bought by a bigger studio.
Yes, and what's Majestic best known for? Well, probably Majestic's best known film is The Vampire Bat.
Mm-hmm.
From that same year.
Oh, that's true. Yes, that's right. With Faye Ray, mm-hmm. with another
yes.
Horror.
Lionel Atwell. So it's kind of like a matched set demonstrating the, on the one hand, the cheap thrills and atmospheric power of which a small studio was capable when making not a supernatural thriller, but a science fiction thriller with supernatural overtones.
It gets pretty supernatural there at the end, doesn't it?
It gets a little bit out of the
metaphorical.
That was, of course, when we did the original edition of Forgotten Horrors in 1979, we overlooked that picture, or mm-hmm. For whatever reasons, and I couldn't say which, I was going back over the original manuscript, getting ready to restore the chapters that had been cut out by the original publisher, and going through the American Film Institute catalogs that George Turner and I worked on, and reading a lot of synopses that, like, is there an element of terror in this picture, whether or not it's an out-and-out horror movie. Mm-hmm. And the reference to the ghost of Nora Moran showing up toward the end of the picture,
yes,
says, gosh, why did we omit that? Because there is a ghostly apparition that might be a figment of someone's imagination, but then again, it might be the actual disembodied spirit.
Right.
And so I said, okay, this bears some research. Got a print, secured a print, took a screening, took another screening, fresh look, time and again. Couldn't stop watching this picture because of its complicated and fascinating structure. And so then that brought in the, gosh, this picture reminds me of something, and I couldn't quite place it until I flashed on the Preston Sturges,
yes,
screenplay, mm-hmm, for The Power and the Glory. I said, mm-hmm, of course, that's where it's coming from. And it turns out that Majestic Pictures was really quick to pick up on this word narratage that Fox Film Corp, uh-huh, had invented.
So they thought that maybe they were, would it be safe to say or correct to say that they were kind of piggybacking off of the Sturges film?
Certainly in the marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not in the story.
No.
And in the downright surreal qualities where, well, for example, a character in the present day appears wearing a wardrobe from an earlier period of time.
Yes. Yes,
what's
very sophisticated in that way. Yeah.
Really haunting
mm-hmm
effects.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the film doesn't really try too hard. It plays out more like a modern-day picture of the present day than a lot of pictures from the 30s. It doesn't really look old-fashioned.
No, in some ways it looks ahead of
its time. It's got a kind of an avant-garde feel to it.
Yes, it absolutely does. And part of it, I also think, is all of the, like, the dissolves and the washes and the things that they have that they'll do. Like, I don't have the terminology, you probably do, but the half-dissolve, where they'll go over and darken a scene all of a sudden, or they'll,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
do something.
Layers falling,
yes,
in upon new layers,
yes,
and new layers, and then folding back to reveal the underlying texture of the story. And gosh, things are just about to reach the breaking point, and you think somebody's got to save this poor woman.
Yes.
Not only from the death penalty, but also from her insistence upon taking the rap.
That's right. That's right. And very, very, very self-sacrificing. Kind of an idea of juxtaposed with all of this avant-garde kinds of storytelling is a very old-fashioned moralistic thing that has to do with sacrificing motherhood and putting, you know, women on a pedestal and the obverse of that. There's so much of that going on. So at the same time, you have the avant-garde licks going on with the dissolves and with the flash forwards and flashbacks. You also have this very, very, at its core, a very old-fashioned story when it comes to the relationship between men and women.
Right.
And the
long-suffering wife, the long-suffering mistress.
Right, right.
And the bad rascal that puts him in this difficult position. And the even worse rascal who returns from the past to get what's coming to him.
Right. And the mistress is the sympathetic one, not the wife in this case.
Right. The wife rides her husband out of, she's probably got as much crooked ambition as he does.
Mm-hmm.
And she has attached herself to the politician's brilliant career, probably more out of greed or hunger for prestige than out of selfless unconditional love.
Yeah, I never believe she loves her husband.
No. You get a very clear picture that this is not the healthiest marital situation you could come across.
Yes, yet the mistress truly loves the man.
Oh, yeah.
Moran does. And so that's another thing that probably couldn't have been done once the Legion of Decency got its hooks into the production code in 1934, right? I mean, just that whole storyline would have probably been verboten.
Come to think of it, yes. Yeah. The Legion of Decency was gathering steam in 1933, and they were already making a ruckus, but they didn't get their chokehold on the Motion Picture Association until mid-1934. And, of course, that's the year that Universal had such censorship problems with The Black Cat, Edgar Ulmer's picture, mm-hmm. with Karloff and Lugosi, and with One More River.
I don't know that.
Which is of course, a Colin Clive, Lionel Atwell, et cetera, star, not a horror film as those actors are often associated with,
yes.
but a really, really intense psychoerotic story.
I don't know that film at all. Is it Universal?
That's a Universal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that may be one
a lot of
we'll
pictures
have to
felt
for
the axe, but those two felt it in particular. And you could look up the American, you know, we've got the American Film Institute catalog of motion pictures online now.
Oh.
And
you and George Turner, I should say.
Those huge cloth-bound volumes that George Turner and I mm-hmm. helped with.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, that 5-foot shelf may just sit there for a while, because now you can do it online, and the American Film Institute catalog of motion pictures contains immense background, not only on synopses, cast credits, but also on the backstory involving the Motion Picture Association and how they dealt with censorship.
Well, we should mention, or I should mention, that you and George Turner were the originators of the Forgotten Horrors books. I came aboard after George passed in 1999, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right.
And on the third volume, and you and George had a little bit different ideas. And I've always, when people ask me about the Forgotten Horrors books, I always go, as you probably do, to Lovecraft, because you told me that years ago.
The idea
from his essay that horror is where you find it.
Yeah, it's like, and the horrific element, the hair-raising quality, often is found in stories of an entirely different cast.
Like The Sin of Norma Moran.
Right, exactly.
This is
what could be more horrifying than being totally alienated from everything?
Right, right. And doing it of your own accord.
Yeah.
Doing it because you believe that there's something beyond yourself, which I find very noble in the whole deal. I thought when we watched it, and I was just stunned by the picture, and I certainly am going to watch it again. But when I watched the picture, when Joey and I watched the picture, our producer Joey Hambrick and I watched the picture, once I realized it was from a stage play, I thought that a lot of that, the dissolves and the things that they did, the really kind of Rococo elements, were to keep it from being stage bound. Do you feel that way?
That is pretty much the take I have. Phil Goldstone did not get to make many pictures as a director. He should have.
He
was more commonly a producer. He produced The Vampire Bat at the same studio. He went on as a producer up into the early 40s. He was producer and director kind of by default on Nora Moran. They had personnel difficulties, and finally he took over the direction, and I thought brought a style that, as I mentioned earlier, I think foreshadows David Lynch to a large degree. His pictures as a producer are much more famous than his pictures as a director. Goldstone was he was like a silent partner on White Zombie in 1932.
So he stuck around at Poverty Row his whole career, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He his last picture as a director was not only Poverty Row, but also Medicinal Poverty Row, a little studio called Criterion, in which Phil Goldstone took a pseudonym to do Damaged Goods in 1937.
The venereal
and that was his last picture as a director.
Yeah, the VD film.
The VD film, yes.
I did not know that. That's his last credit?
That's his last directing credit. He went on producing into the early 40s.
And still, and never rose above, I guess once you were in Poverty Row, whether you were an actor or a producer, you stayed there, right?
Well, as a producer, he, of course, well, he produced one of the bigger Tarzans, Tarzan Escapes.
Oh, he did?
Which ran into real censorship problems.
And that was for whom?
That was for MGM.
For MGM. Okay, so he did get out
so
of Poverty
he
Row.
He wasn't an outcast so much as he just knew his place and usually stayed in it.
Like Edgar Ulmer.
Like Edgar Ulmer.
Mm-hmm.
Very like Edgar Ulmer.
Okay.
Of course, he went from the large credential of Tarzan Escapes to the below disreputable picture Damaged Goods in 1937.
Uh-huh.
Then he rose somewhat again to do one of the Renfrew of the Royal Mounted Pictures.
Oh, my. Now, was that Monogram?
That was Grand National, as I recall.
Yes, right.
I believe Grand National, actually Criterion handled it, but they were, there was a lot of blurring among Grand National, Monogram, PRC, Criterion.
It was all pages in the same book, wasn't it?
Yes, a lot of crossover there, and the corporate name changed, but frequently the personnel looked awfully familiar.
Well, you know, I think you and I are both in agreement, and I know Joey is, that we would recommend that anybody see The Sin of Norm Ran just to see stuff that I don't know if filmmaking's caught up to some of that stuff yet.
It's very difficult to find a more provocative, more convoluted, and I mean that in a good way.
Yes, you're right.
The story plays out like, what's the best thing you can say about a movie? It's like you're watching somebody else's dream. And it takes you into places that your conscious mind probably wouldn't let you go. The portrait of anguish is there throughout. It's not a picture with a lot of leavening.
No, it's not.
It has moments of passing, fleeting joy.
Understand why I'm asking you to do this? Don't you realize that it isn't killing him that will ruin you? It's me. The months we've spent here. They'll take those months from us and spread them across the front page of every newspaper. They'll make them ugly and cheap instead of what they were. I'm not asking you to be cowardly. I'm asking you to let me keep the only happiness I've ever known.
But
or hope, perhaps. Maybe fleeting hope.
Fleeting hope. Mm-hmm. And then there's a hopeful ending, despite the downer. And let's not give away too much. But,
no, that's not.
You know, you want a film to be able to spring its own surprises in its own sweet time. The picture does end on almost a note that says, yeah, everything's going to be all right, maybe.
Maybe.
So it's a hopeful ending and not a happy ending.
That's right. I agree. And you were talking a little bit, if we can tie up some loose ends, about Zita Johann. What happened to her in her career?
Not a lot, doggone it. One wonders why. One wonders why she didn't work more extensively during the 30s, but she was gone from Hollywood by 1934.
Do you know what happened to her? Did she get married and leave the business, or just leave the business, or do you know what happened?
She had several marriages.
Uh-huh.
John Houseman being the most recognizable name. Three marriages, let's say.
Uh-huh.
She lived on to an advanced age, 89, died in 1993.
Did she ever do conventions or anything like that, as far as you know?
Not that I know. I've made a lot of those movie buff trade shows, and I've never seen her at such a thing. She made the damnedest comeback, if you can call it that, in 1986 with a small role in Raiders of the Living Dead.
Oh, yes, the one from Independent International.
Yes.
The kid from the toy is growing up, and he's made a laser gun from a video player.
The last guy who went poking around out there didn't come back.
When zombies start taking over the town and the kid's got the only protection, watch out.
Maybe I could save them. Here goes nothing.
When the going gets tough, the tough get armed, and the wimps are eaten for lunch.
Shoot them!
They're back from the dead, and they don't eat potato salad.
Come on, what are you waiting for?
Yes, was that an Al Adamson film?
Sam Sherman.
Al Adamson directed, correct?
Yeah, I would have to look that up.
It was a Sam Sherman film.
Actually,
yes.
I think Sam directed Raiders of the Living Dead.
I remember seeing so many pieces about that in the trade journals and ads and things and Variety. Did
and, of course,
a
Sam Sherman picture, Sam usually produces.
Right.
But a Sam Sherman picture and an Al Adamson picture are very much alike because they both learned the trade from Al's father.
Denver Dixon.
Yes, or Denver Dixon.
However many
Victor
names.
Adamson.
Yeah, Victor Adamson, sure.
Yeah.
Well, all right. We want to recommend that anybody take a look at the film. It's free. You can see it on several different, and there's, like I say, there's a beautiful, Joey's going to put up the link. Right, Joey?
Yeah.
He's going to put up the link for it. And so the people who listen to the podcast can come watch it. And I really think it's just an hour and change, and it's certainly worth that hour and change of your time, I believe.
Very rewarding. Very rewarding.
Let's
remember that word, narratage.
And
you may never see it again, but when you see it, you'll know what it is.
And try and use this week, those within the sound of our voice, try and use the term narratage in some way or another this next week, and you'll flabbergast your friends. Michael, what are we plugging these days? What do you got coming up?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we've got how many volumes of Forgotten Horrors do we have in print?
Six plus
the first degree. The first two volumes have been revised and expanded.
Uh-huh.
They are sitting right there on the virtual kiosks at Amazon.com.
And the first the first one has your piece on Nora Moran.
That covers that early Depression years period. Second volume gets into the wartime period. The volumes 3 and 4 are still awaiting their expanded editions, but they are in print in the original editions. And then we get into the entirely new stuff with, Volume 5, Volume 6, and then the present-day capper, Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree.
Which I'm really hearing some nice things about.
One of these days we're going to backtrack and finish up Volume 7, which will be The Bridge.
Right. And we will. We'll do that. And I know we've been talking about that, so that'll happen. But meanwhile, you can just pretty much start at any of those books that you want to. Whatever, if you don't want to start at the first, whatever era you're interested in, you can find going up to the 50s. And, of course, Nth Degree goes from basically from the beginning of the gore era, Blood Feast in 1964, to the beginning of the home video era, Blood Cult in 1984.
Yeah.
And I just talked to our friend Mark Lamberti, just wrote me about the book.
Oh,
copy of the book. Mark Lamberti, people may know Mark. He was in charge of a TV station down in Dallas for many years. He's a great writer and had syndicate films back in the 16mm days. And I was going to tell you, he just wrote me and told me how much he was enjoying the book.
That's wonderful.
So I've got a new book out called Hardboiled Christmas Stories. And
yes.
John McMahon and I, my partner John McMahon and I in Reverse Karma Press, which Michael, you gave us the name for the press. Reverse Karma Press has just brought out its first book, and that's Hardboiled Christmas Stories. We have 9 stories from the golden age of the pulps all with hardboiled detectives in Christmas settings. And then I wrote a new Dan Turner story called Santa's Sleigh Ride. That would be S-L-A-Y.
Yep.
Called Santa's Sleigh Ride in the style of Robert Leslie Bellum's Dan Turner Hollywood Detective. So it's the first new Dan Turner Hollywood Detective prose story in over 60 years. Anybody who might be interested in that, we're not on Amazon, but you can check my website out, which is www.johnwooley, johnwooley.com. That's johnwooley.com. And you can also see actually some blogs about the last two Forgotten Horrors, or the latest two Forgotten Horrors books that Michael and I have done. How are you coming on the Iger books? Anything on your comic book?
The comics from the Gone World series.
Yes.
I'm actually putting together some an appendix of comic book stories for the new Most Dangerous Game book, which will be coming together one of these days. I've reverted to George Turner's my original manuscript ideas.
And that is to do all of the films together that have to do with the Most Dangerous Game, or have that concept?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Right. In fact, we've got an absurd new comic book character who will be making his debut in a retooled wartime story. In fact, from Whiz Comics.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we're giving it the Comics from the Gone World treatment, which means it won't resemble much of anything of its original form. And of course, it stars that intrepid adventurer Mose Danger.
For those of you who don't know the comics from the Gone World, I recommend them highly. I've had them on my Christmas list for the past couple of years, and usually get one or two every Christmas. And it's essentially comic book stories given a kind of a Dada twist by Michael. kind of a Carlos Castaneda pick the ones that appear in your path twist.
Mm-hmm.
With the stories that he does from the old horror comics, and he'll write all new captions, and yet the internal logic, the thing I admire most about the stories, about the comics from the Gone World, is the internal logic always continues to make sense. In fact, probably makes more sense than it did in the original comics.
Well, I've always felt it a pity that some of those pre-censorship comic books had such striking artwork and such lame-brain scripts. So of course, I stole the idea from Woody Allen with What's Up, Tiger Lily.
Of course you did. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is the man who took a Charlton Hot Rod comic and turned it into a Jean-Paul Sartre essay on being in nothingness. And is that available, by the way, Beating That Nothingness?
Not in print just now. I'll have to do something about that.
I think you'd better. But there are plenty of, if you're looking for something unusual for that hard-to-buy-for person in your life, boy, don't go any farther than Michael H. Price. Michael, it's always a pleasure. And
delighted.
Have a lovely holiday season, and we'll be back at you soon. We want to thank everybody for listening. We want to thank our producer, Joey Hambrick, who is really expanding the visibility of our podcasts. We're getting a lot of new members on our group. What do you call that, Joey?
Forgotten Horrors Podcast.
The Forgotten Horrors Podcast
Facebook
group.
Of course.
Yes. And we're just very delighted with what Joey's doing for us. And thank you all for listening. And Michael, thank you. We'll be back at you soon.
Back with you before you know it.